You're fine, don't worry.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Friday, April 17th, 1 o'clock. Actually, 1:18.
12.
Open a hearing on House Bill 3394, Representative Kimmer.
House Bill?
Yes, you can.
House Bill 3394 creates specific requirements for the training, licensure, and certification of private security guards.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you. I'm Bill Kenemer, State Representative from District 39, and I appreciate the opportunity to be before you on House Bill 3394. With me is Brenda Hyatt and her son David Breams, and Brenda and I go back to 1987 when I first came to the legislature, and a single mom came and said, there are some enormous problems with child support, and we need to do something about it. And she helped me create an avalanche that came through Judiciary Committee back in those days and brought some great changes. And we have become friends across the years. On my return this year, she came and she said, you know, I'm now in the private security business, and I think there are some serious issues about training standards and a number of issues. Would you introduce a bill on my behalf? So that's what this is. House Bill 3394 is about the people who are the eyes and ears for law enforcement. It seems that there are some issues about their training, and maybe we need to take a look at that, and this bill is an opportunity to discuss that and see what we ought to do. And I think there are some interesting revenue issues that have been raised, and Brenda will also address those. One of the things about security people, they're often the first people on the scenes, and I wonder if there shouldn't be some consideration about training in first aid and CPR. And there's an issue about security people, they having guns. It's an interesting one. These people, while they have them, are not mandated to practice. They only have 24 hours of required training and 4 hours on the range. I think that poses some interesting questions. Also, when you have about 16,000 people in the workforce in this type of work, I wonder if it wouldn't be helpful if they had training on how to interact with the police, the courts, and write a report. There are security interactions with the public, children, criminals, law enforcement, and the courts. And it seems to me that in the name of efficiency and good justice, we may want to look at tightening the standards. At this point, my concern is that security agents can often be people with practically no training. It's been brought to my attention that DPSST could, with policy, have raised these standards, but they haven't. So I think it's time to have that discussion, and I appreciate your patience and indulgence in consideration of House Bill 3394.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman Barker and members of the committee, my name is Brenda Hyatt, and sitting next to me is my son and business partner, David Breams. A couple of years ago, we started a security company, and I have had my eyes open seriously wide since starting this company. One, I have business experience, but I had never, the only security experience I had ever had was approximately 2 months as a security guard some 20 or 30 years ago. And I was able to walk into DPSST, and I took my unarmed security license, which made me an unarmed security guard in a matter of 12 hours, an 8-hour course and a 4-hour module. And then I took another 8-hour course, which made me an executive manager. Short of having my armed license, that put me on an equal footing with every police captain in this state. I am now legally able to license as many security guards, and unarmed, as I see fit in this state. If it weren't for the fact that I am fairly astute in business, I don't feel that qualifies me for anything. I spent 16 hours in class being taught how not to get arrested and how not to make the police mad. I'm sorry. I already knew how not to make the police mad. My mother taught me that years ago. And it's just, It amazes me the pool of people I have to hire from out there. I have received emails on this bill that call into question whether or not I'm trying to limit the workforce. I'm not trying to limit the workforce, but we cannot, as the eyes and ears of the police department, of people out there who represent private security, who protect the persons and the property of people in the state of Oregon, we cannot any longer afford to accept the standards that has been set forth by DPSST. It was brought to my attention that back in 2005, this very committee, through Senate Bill 61, set in place the policy committees and the board for DPSST. In probably 50 to 100 places in that bill, it changed the wording from private security officer to private security professional. By what standards are we called professionals? The course for the food handler's test is more difficult than the course for private security officers. The current training for private security officers for unarmed is 12 hours. 8 hours of a book class, 4 hours of a testing module, and if you only have to pass that testing module with a 70%, and basically what you've got is you've got a trainer that is sitting there reading the book to you, and then when they are done reading the book to you, you take a test right on the back of that. And it is not an open book test, but you're taking the test right on the back of that. And if you fail to get a 70%, the trainer still has the option of sitting down and talking to you and asking you what it is you don't understand about the question that you were asked. And if you can satisfy them that you might have some modicum of an understanding, they can still pass you that day. And if you fail to pass that day, you can keep coming back every. We don't even meet the same minimum standards that are set for the driver's license test, the test that we expect 15 and 16-year-olds to take. They at least have to wait 24 hours and then a little bit of time after that to take the test. Armed security has been raised to 24 hours, which includes a four-hour module at the shooting range. Now, my bill does say 16 additional hours, but it includes 8 hours on the shooting range, which is also 24 hours. But if you upgrade the unarmed security that they also have to take and make them include all of the provisions that we have put in the unarmed part, it's going to naturally upgrade the armed part. As far as CPR, first aid, and AED trained, we are quite frequently the first responders on a site. And I have received a couple of emails in the last couple of days that call into question the basic trained CPR person. The Red Cross emphasizes the need to try and train everybody in CPR, first aid, and AED training. The Red Cross is not an agency to take lightly, and they believe that everybody needs training, yet we, as possible first responders, are not mandated by any kind of policy, law, or regulation to have first aid training. They will put a gun in our hands. We can shoot somebody. We can wrestle somebody to the ground. We can handcuff somebody, but we're not mandated to use first aid training. Now, I would really like you to explain to somebody when they're sitting there after they've been shot that we're not mandated to take care of them after that until the ambulance or the police arrive. The executive manager training has absolutely nothing in it about field management, customer or public interaction. It does tell you have to maintain employment records for a certain amount of time. It gives you no clue how to do that, none whatsoever. If you do not have business sense before you go in there, if you have never ran a business, when you come out, you still will not know how to run a business. I sincerely believe that asking for an 80% proficiency on a test and not allowing somebody to talk their way through their mistakes is very minimal standards at best. That's not even a B average in our grade schools. The as far as the compliance part, that's the part that seems to hit the fiscal impact statement the most. We already have officers, we already have people in place who are supposed to be doing compliance. I'm not asking them to go out and beat down doors and force compliance. What I'm asking is that when an investigation is open, that they actually do something about the business or the agency that is not in compliance within 7 days. And I have done that by inserting in there that I want them to issue a corrective notice. I'm not asking them to find them guilty, responsible, fine them, and everything else within 7 days, which is what the impact statement of the agency actually says. It says it's going to open the agency up to lawsuits and everything else. I'm asking them to simply do what the same representatives for the Food Handlers Commission does, which is issue a corrective notice and then follow up on that corrective notice. I can give you two major examples right here in this state. In September, it came to my attention that the Sandy Union School District, or Oregon Trail School District, as it is now known, was out of compliance with their security. They had a police officer who was heading up their security team who did not have his executive manager training. He had an unlicensed security guard, two of them, working under him. The Gresham Barlow School District had a staff of 6 security agents that were working under their security manager, again, with no executive manager training, no DPSST cards.
Can I ask you to summarize, because
sure.
We have a...
I worked with these. I
Thank
worked
you.
With these two school districts for over 2 months. I took it to DPSST when I was getting nowhere. That was in October, or the first part of November. In April, the Sandy School District, I believe, may have finally gotten their executive manager training. There was absolutely nothing done by DPSST between October and April. So I'm just asking, I'm not trying to undo SB 61. I'm not trying to undo their board. I'm trying to give them some direction. Add this to the curriculum. You work it any way you want to. You put it in the curriculum anywhere you want to. You go get your approval any way you want to. But let's put this stuff in the curriculum. Let's set up these time frames so that something's actually getting done. The price tag on this reads like a wish list. There is absolutely no way that the cost for this bill should be anywhere near $250,000. Not in anybody's dream. I believe, one other thought, as far as weeding out the employees, we're still going to have a force of 16,000. We're still going to have the same amount of applicants a year. What we're weeding out is the people who are simply not qualified to do the job, people who absolutely cannot write a report, people who absolutely cannot protect people, people who absolutely cannot interact with law enforcement. I'm simply asking you to bring up these standards.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and we don't have the fiscal report yet, so we'll have to...
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a quick
question? Yes, I'm sorry. Representative Shields?
Yeah, you own a business that does security, correct?
Yes, I do.
And then, so this happens quite a bit in, you know, business and labor. We'd see bills where different businesses would come forward and say, you know, we need more regulation, and we've decided that we're willing to increase the fees on ourselves to pay for this. Do the private security companies themselves pay for any of the licensing, or is it only the individuals?
Some of the private security companies, like our company, for instance, we assist with paying for the license fees and the training. It really depends on the individual company whether they're willing to help pay for that or not. We do help pay for it. I believe DePaul helps pay for theirs. I'm not sure how many. Pardon? Securitas helps pay for theirs. The fee range on this, again, it's a matter of productivity. You know,
okay,
as Representative Kenemer was saying, when I came before this very committee, different people, different makeup, but same thing 20-plus years ago, and asked you guys to straighten out the Child Support Agency. I ask you, I was fighting a committee that said, oh, this is going to cost us billions. We can't possibly make any money off of that. That's not true. If we increase the standards, if we increase public trust, we're going to increase jobs, because more people are going to be willing to hire private security.
And Mr. Chair, yes. Just one follow-up. I mean, would you, like I said, business industry usually pays for these kinds of things. Would you be willing as a company to pay $500, $1,000 to have this level of training monitored?
I cannot say I'd be willing to pay $500. We're paying $100. Between the class and the license right now, we're paying $175 for each person we put on the street.
That's just unarmed.
That's unarmed. Of course, the armed is more. And we truly understand that that's going to have to go up. There's no way that it can't. But there's no reason for it to go up 100% or even, 200-300%, which is what you're talking about at the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. Close the public hearing on 3394 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2860. Representative Esquivel.
House Bill 2860 requires the Department of Human Services to proceed with termination of parental rights in cases where a court has removed a child from their home on three or more occasions, creates a conclusive presumption that the parent is unfit for purposes of termination of parental rights proceeding when a child has been removed three or more times, exempts department from the requirement to make reasonable efforts to return a child to the home in cases where a child has been removed three or more times. In this case, again, we do not have a fiscal statement issued.
Okay, thank you. Representative Esquivel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill. I think more than anything, it needs to be aired publicly of what we're doing to our children in our system. This actually started when a friend of mine and a colleague that I was on the city council with had his grandchildren three times in 4 years. And I know that's startling. But we have a drug problem in this state that's out of hand. You have irresponsible parents, and they are out of hand. And yet we continue to work with these people, which is fine. But after three times that you've jerked that child out of the home, put it in a foster home and or with relatives, when do we start evaluating the psychological damage we're doing to the children? You're going to get opposition, I'm sure, from ACLU on this. And what's interesting about this, the DHS people asked me to bring this forward. 12 o'clock today, DHS says, we're going to have to oppose this bill. Fact. They said it may have some constitutional issues, which is fine. We need to see if it is a constitutional issue. But let me explain how this system works. They pull a child away from the parents. The parent agrees to certain steps over a year period of time and has to comply with this. And I might add, in my particular area, which is nothing to do with this, but sometimes we don't, as a state, follow up to see if they are exactly adhering to the agreement. Example, drug testing. But if everything's copacetic, within 9 months to a year, the child goes back to the parents. Then the next infraction, which sometimes doesn't take very long, bam, we have that child back in foster care or children. In this case, it was plural. We go through the same process again, 9 months to a year. The child goes back to the parents. Short period of time later, we pull the child back out. They're back in the system again, either with foster care parents and or relatives. Again, we repeat that process over and over. My question from the DHS workers was, well, how many times do you do that for the psychological well-being of the child?
You can imagine if you're 3 years old
and in 4 years, when you're seven, you've been in and out of your own home three different times and with different people maybe three different times. When do we ask the question, who's sticking up for the children?
When is enough enough?
They said there was no law that governed it. They said there is no time frame. If that's the case, we need to air this out, and we need to find out if, in fact, we can initiate some sort of a time frame or some sort of a criteria, because the injustice we're doing to these children is irreparable. And usually kids that are in and out of a system usually end up in a system. I ran into one child, well, an adult now, that had been into 17 different foster parent homes. Individual was only 19. That's pretty pathetic. And you know, that young man had some real problems. Well, why wouldn't you? So I ask for your indulgence on this. Thanks for having the public hearing. I think it needs to be aired, and I think it's time that someone took a position to help these children instead of worrying so much about the drug-addicted adults that aren't coming up to the litmus test and taking care of their own families. And it's time that we took a stand for these kids and their psychological well-being.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Smith.
Thanks for the spirit that you bring this, Representative Esquivel. Do we know, you know a lot more about this than I do we know anything in the treatment realm that happens? Do we know, are there various steps we could take either in addition to this or in lieu of this that might help alleviate some of the problems and protect the kids?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we have a standard procedure. We have kind of a contract.
Okay, if you go to drug rehab, if you take so many, urine analysis during a certain period of time and this, and you learn how to cope with anger management or whatever the situation may be, we try to work that into where they meet that criteria, and then after that criteria is met, we send the child back. Now, the shortcoming of the system is, one, and I'm going to give you an example of one particular case down in Southern Oregon where in a year and about 3 months, they had 7 different caseworkers. That's a problem. No one, we kind of lost a handle on it. There was no drug testing for over 6 months, is my understanding, where there was supposed to have been. Now, consequently, we sent that child back to their parent, it was a single parent, but unfortunately, while that individual was being involved in the process, she ended up having another child. So we end up with 2 children now that are at risk in this system. Now, I hope it works out, but we will see. There is set procedures, but we as a state do not adhere to those procedures ourselves. That's part of the problem. But the other real problem is it's like a ping pong ball. And we're using these children as the ping pong ball itself. And I think it's time that we stepped up to the plate and said, enough's enough. We need to take care and worry about this child. The parent are making their own decisions, and they seem to be bad. So when does the accountability come into place?
Okay, thank you. Representative Stigler.
I want to, Representative Esquivel, I want to echo Representative Smith's praise for you to at least bringing to the forefront the frustration I think that a lot of people who work in this arena feel, that oftentimes that the focus is taken away from the child. And so I do applaud you for at least raising this issue, and we may not get where we need to go yet, but at least it starts the conversation, and I do want to thank you for that.
Well, in order to move a boulder, you have to start it. Mr. Chair, I do want to add one thing, that these workers that we have in the state seem to, for some reason, we have a horrible, horrible turnover in them. I don't know where they go, whether they get burnt out. I don't know whether they get promoted. I don't know whether they just run away from this thing because, you know, they see a lot of the worst in our society. But that is a real problem, and the sad part about it is every time you change that individual, that caseworker, the one that takes their place, they don't have a clue what's going on. So you basically start over again. So that's something that we need to work on.
Representative Shields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you're absolutely right. I would just say that the challenge is not just for caseworkers. It's foster parents when you take a child from one home to another home because the foster parents haven't been provided the proper training. You end up kind of with the child's behavior getting worse and worse over time. Same thing with the lawyers who, when our foster daughter must have had three lawyers in the course of 6 months who we had to start over with each time. And then foster parents, you know, getting paid $400 a month. I mean, all those things, I think, underline huge problems in the system. And I think you're right that you absolutely have to begin working somewhere. So I just applaud you for bringing this forward and shining some light on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Sybil Hebb and Maura Roach.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 2860. I would echo the appreciation for the representatives bringing the discussion forward. I would, however, say that from the perspective of a family law attorney and from the perspective of the Oregon Law Center in dealing with many families, low-income families, who are struggling with issues related to drug abuse or domestic violence, or mental health issues who sometimes end up in the child welfare system, I think we would say that having a one-size-fits-all response to the individual circumstances of a family is not effective and can, in some circumstances, end up having a more negative impact on children than would be than otherwise. The central concept around our family law statutes is to focus on making decisions that take into account all of the facts and circumstances so that the best interests of the children can be met. The needs of children as well as families are individual and depend on the circumstances, and so it's important that those circumstances be taken into account. One child may have a great deal of resilience through three placements in foster care. Not to say that that's ever ideal, but one child may have a great deal of resilience and parents may have a great deal of incentive to be continuing to deal with their struggles, and there may be very strong bonds that continue between that parent and that child. And so it's just important to ask those questions and to look at those circumstances when designing a response to families who are struggling, and we think that that's a central code concept of the family law code. It's also a central concept of the juvenile code to have child-centered solutions, and there are just simply not one-size-fits-all solutions for individuals. So we very much appreciate, again, the attention to this issue, and I would suggest that one great place to start with this discussion is looking at some of the recommendations that came forward as a result of the governor's and the department's efforts to have a work group during the last interim. There was a child safety work group that brought together people from a variety of different perspectives on this issue. There were foster parents there, foster children, as well as advocates for parents and children and the department. And there were a number of recommendations that came forward that were designed to prevent the need for children and families to seek the services of the child welfare system in the first place, also to help the system respond more effectively to help get children home safely, more effectively while they're in the system, and then also to provide support to parents, foster parents, during that process, and support to foster children as they leave the foster care system, either to return home or to go out on their own as they become adults. And so there's sort of a broad range of issues to be considered, and that group has a good list of recommendations, and I endorse those recommendations as a member of that work group and would be happy to participate in any further discussions about this. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your continuing work.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach, and I'm here to provide testimony by the Juvenile Rights Project. On behalf of Lisa Kay, one of our staff attorneys, who unfortunately is at the Juvenile Law Conference in Newport today, along with a lot of the rest of our staff. I, too, would just like to start off by saying that I think the interim child safety work group recommendations are something that would be worth looking at. JRP was an active member of that work group, and as was just referred to by my colleague here, there were a number of important recommendations that came out of that. As you are aware, Juvenile Rights Project is a nonprofit public defense firm in Multnomah County who 80% of our workload is, in fact, dependency proceedings and representing foster care children, and we too have a number of concerns about HB 2860. 2860 mandates a narrow response to a multifaceted system. Reentry into the foster care system is harmful to children and devastating for families. And however, children reenter the foster care system for many reasons, including failure to access services that are needed and sometimes even court-ordered to keep children from reentering foster care. This failure will not only occur with more frequency as services related to drug and alcohol treatment, mental health treatment, and domestic violence services, as well as housing and other critical services are being cut. The proposed solution is already available under the law. The termination of parental rights petition can be filed at any time by the court after the court has changed the plan from a permanent plan to adoption. Permanency hearings can occur at any time, and the court can conduct a permanency hearing at any time upon request of DHS, parents, or other parties to the case. Once requested, the permanency hearing can occur as soon as possible, and adoption and termination of parental rights is only one permanent plan for children. There are other permanent plans, which include permanent guardianship and other options. And I think it's important to note that the child can reach permanency under that situation without termination of parental rights. And that also means that the child is eligible for other types of rights, like rights of survivorship and other things that attach to the familial relationship to the parent. And it's not always in the best interest of the child, frankly, to sever those. Since you have my written testimony, I'll just conclude by saying that, you know, again, Juvenile Rights Project agrees that reentry to the foster system is harmful to children and devastating for families. However, we don't think a one-size-fits-all solution is the right way to go. The best way to improve outcomes for children is to give DHS and the juvenile court system adequate resources to select and implement the best plan for each child and each family in each case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is a little tangential, but I'm glad this bill is brought forward because we rarely have a chance, and this might be the first time that we've had a real conversation about the impact of parenting on outcomes, etc. And I must admit two things. First, from many indications, just about every indication I can find, the quality and attention of parenting, one of the most outcomes-relevant factor in child development that we know. We know about that for education, parental involvement in schools. We know that for public safety and crime. We know that. The second thing I must admit is I have almost no good idea about how to facilitate improvement. Maybe it's just something that has to happen naturally, and we write books, and we hope, and everything's, you know. Are there any, you know, what's the most innovative thinking out there? What are the ideas out there? Who are good people to ask when we're thinking about how do we, or if we can, provide, you know, tools to parents? You know, I don't know if it's, you know, parental training classes. I don't know if it's saying please on TV. I mean, you know, I am tabula rasa, willing to learn. Where should I go to learn?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Smith, it's a good question, and there are probably lots of answers. A couple of things that occur to me are that, again, I think that was the goal of the Child Safety Work Group, is to sort of ask some of those questions, and they looked at some of the national experts as well as some of the locals. There's something called the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. They have, they're sort of widely perceived to be the experts in how can we respond to this issue, this crisis, nationally, and they have a number of recommendations, and the Child Safety Work Group looked and has worked closely with members of that group. I guess one example that I could provide for you is that from my perspective, we've been very interested in the issue of domestic violence and how that results often in referrals to the child welfare system. Domestic violence, substance abuse, and mental health are the top three drivers of founded child welfare cases and top three reasons for removal of a child into substitute care. And so looking at how can we resolve those problems and provide services to families that address those needs that are available and accessible and appropriate to try to resolve, and then that reduces the need and helps to put parents in a place in which they can be caring and safe functioning parents. And so, you know, I could go on, and I know that's... So I'd be happy to talk to you more those issues. But I think the Child Safety Work Group is really the place in Oregon where we have the greatest focus of recommendations.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you very much, panel. Beth Englander and Gail Shelley.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up,
yes.
I just wanted to call Representative Smith's attention to the Public Safety Strategies Task Force that we worked on in the interim, did a foster care day, and if you go to toughandsmart.net, you can see all the documents, including testimony from the Child Safety Work Group.
Thanks. Thank you, Representative Shields. Please go ahead.
Right. Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm Beth Englander, and I'm the Adoption Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families Division, and I'm here to testify in opposition to HB 2860. You're being provided with written testimony, and I think that before I begin, I would like to let you know that I'm going to actually shorten my remarks because much of what I would have shared with you already has already been addressed by the two prior speakers. And what I would like to do, first of all, first and foremost, is to acknowledge again, as the previous speakers have acknowledged, that we certainly agree with the need for stability for children who are in foster care, and certainly agree that it is important to effect safe reunification with parents, and when that is not possible, to effect a permanent plan that is safe, and to do that in as a timely a manner as possible. As written, the bill requires or creates, rather, a quantitative basis for filing a termination of parental rights petition, or TPR, at the cost of, we believe, of efforts by the department to determine the best interest of the child and make statutorily required reasonable efforts, or in the case of children who are covered by the Indian Child Welfare Act, active efforts to prevent removal or provide reunification services to children and parents. The conclusive presumption that a parent is unfit on the basis of the number of removals rather than an assessment of the child's needs and their ability and the parent's ability to safely take care of the child and parent them would preclude an opportunity for parents to demonstrate that they're not automatically unfit to parent. Consequently, it's expected, we would expect that there will be an increased number of contested hearings at the time of shelter, because those shelter hearings could potentially establish a basis for a future termination of parental rights petition. When reunification is no longer viable, the department must identify an appropriate permanent plan for the child and make reasonable or active efforts to achieve timely permanency. In fact, we're required by federal law and by state statute to schedule a permanency hearing for the child by 12 months following the initial placement. And by the time a child has been in care for 15 out of 22 months, we would at that time be further required to proceed to pursue termination and proceed to the alternate plan or adoption. So the department must identify an appropriate permanent plan for the child, make reasonable or active efforts to achieve timely permanency. In the absence of time up front, right after a child has entered care, to provide services to remedy the conditions and circumstances that have brought the child into care, the department's ability to thoughtfully plan for permanency could be impacted. And this would include the efforts to diligently recruit for permanent resources, and we believe that this could potentially lead to more children remaining in foster care. It's also unclear how our federal partners may interpret this new basis for TPR created by the bill, since it does not allow the department and the court to take into account the degree of detriment and reunification prognosis for the child along with the number of removals. Reasonable and active efforts requirements are tied to federal funding, and states are subject to cyclical federal fiscal and performance reviews that assess reunification and permanency outcomes for children. State noncompliance with federal requirements could result in state corrective action plans and potential federal fund disallowances or penalties. This bill has the potential to impact any child entering care, and potentially could impact children already in care as we speak today, as well as court wards who have been reunited and are continuing to receive services in home, regardless of the period of time over which the removals have occurred. And this is one thing that we're concerned about, is the absence of language that would suggest whether removals in question occur sequentially in a short period of time or perhaps have occurred over a long period of time, in some cases years. We're also concerned that the when parents cannot provide for their child and a child requires a voluntary placement in care in order to have their medical or mental health needs addressed, that this may in fact be a contributing factor toward the number of removals. The department believes that this bill would adversely impact parents and guardians and children served by the child welfare system and lead to potential federal fiscal penalties tied to best interests of the child and timely and appropriate reunification and permanent planning. I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I thank the committee for your time.
Thank you. Gail, why don't you identify yourself, and we'll take questions after.
Yes. For the record, my name is Gail Shelley, and I am an assistant program manager for the adoptions unit, and I'm here to help out with questions if anyone has any questions.
Okay, good. Questions, committee?
I guess.
Representative Krieger?
Thank you, Vice Chair. Kind of so that people understand maybe a little bit of the process. I've been involved in this a little bit the last 5 years. You're moving towards termination, while at the same time you could be moving towards termination. Sometimes they're on the same track. Would you explain why that process is needed? Okay, you move towards termination,
yes,
of parental rights, while at the same time you've got a plan for unification. They're kind of simultaneously going down the track, and some people say it has come out to some of the parents that this is simultaneously taking place, and they lose a lot of faith in the caseworkers. Hey, I thought we were going to get our kids back, and you're over here moving down this other track.
Yes, Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, we do look at what we call concurrent planning when we look at first and foremost returning of a child to a parent, but also looking at what's the best alternative plan for the child, whether it's adoption or another alternative plan. And we do want to pursue both of those plans at the same time so that the child does not remain in care for an extra amount of time if we're not able to reunify the child. There is a lot of work that has to go into it when you are working with the birth parent and helping them to explain that you are making all efforts to reunify the family. But for the child's sake, we have to be looking at other planning, too, in case they are not able to successfully have the child returned to them.
Follow up, please. Just so we get some, this talks about third time or more. Do you have any statistical information about the percent of parents that fail in the first reunification or their recovery plans, and you know that they go back, they get them jerked out? Do we have any percentages that how many that is on fail the first time and the second time?
Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, I don't have the exact numbers with me that you're asking for, and we can certainly get those for the committee. In the written testimony that I provided to you, I do have some data about the total number of children who were removed three or more times, and that begins to get at what you're talking about, although it doesn't speak to the reasons why a child has come back into care. On average, the last 3 years, approximately 177 to 180 children have entered care with three or more removals, which is a small number out of the nearly 5,000 children who enter the system each year, and that's unduplicated in that number. What we do know is that also out of the number of children who were in care at the end of December of last year, or in home but still court ward, had been reunited, approximately, 540, I have the exact number, 540 children had been in care. This was their third time. And out of that number, 439 were actually in their permanent plan. They were in guardianships or in long-term foster care designations, and about another 63 were headed for adoption, for finalization. So out of the total number of children who are in foster care and in the system, it's actually, I think, it was a surprisingly small number to me, in fact, of the number of youngsters who are in care three or more times. Is that a good thing? We don't believe it is. We would like to see children, in fact, if they have to come into care at all, and of course we have a significant focus and effort as a department right now on doing everything possible to serve children at home and keep them there safe to do so. But if they have to come into care at all, we would hope that we would not have recidivism into care again.
Okay, that's fine. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2860 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3348. I'm sorry. I'll close that. We'll go back up the top of the agenda. Open a hearing on House Bill 2292.
House Bill 22 initially reduced minimum duration of special alternative incarceration programs to 240 days. The Dash 3 amendment before the committee deletes the entire bill and provides that the DOC may enter into a contract with a public entity for correctional services in a facility located in another state, declares an emergency, and we do not yet have the fiscal on this.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Max Williams, the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I appreciate you scheduling House Bill 2292. The Dash 3 amendments that you have in front of you are amendments that are acceptable to the Department of Corrections and essentially makes this bill a gut and stuff and completely changes its focus. In 2003, when I was sitting in the chair where Chairman Barker is now, the department came forward with some legislation to provide it the opportunity to house offenders out of state. That opportunity was essentially ending by statute, and it needed to be reauthorized. So in 2003, that authorization was granted. The limitation placed on the agency at the time was that while they could potentially use out-of-state prison rental beds if necessary to manage their increasing population, the limitation was placed on the agency that they were not allowed to use private prisons in order to do that. And that was a compromise that was struck in committee. Obviously, I'm in a different role now than I was then, and so the first version of our efforts on this, the Dash 1 amendment, was to keep all the options on the table for the Department of Corrections. Maximum flexibility in being able to manage a population when one considers the Department of Corrections as the caboose on the criminal justice system. And choices get made about sentencing policy and other issues that have a substantial impact on our population. As the administrator of that system, I believed it was important for us to have flexibility to be able to potentially use out-of-state prison rental beds if necessary. We are fine, however, with the limitation and extending that limitation that was placed in 2003 on the agency by removing the private prison option off the table. This would mean that the agency, if it was going to use out-of-state prison beds, would need to contract with another public agency, another state department of corrections, or potentially another county that operates a large jail system where there might be space available. I want to assure the committee that we don't think that it's good policy to ship inmates out of state. It's not something that we would choose to do. It's not something that we'd even necessarily recommend to do. But because this authorization is expiring at the end of 2009, I felt it important that we at least continue to preserve the department's ability to use this as a backup plan. Whether or not additional changes in sentencing policy, new ballot measures, or even some sort of a natural disaster or a major loss of an institution due to fire or some other damage would leave us shorthanded with how to house offenders. And so this bill does essentially that. It provides us the flexibility we need were we to go down that path. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to respond to any questions. It's really quite straightforward, but would ask the committee's support of the legislation.
Okay, and the Destries remove the private...
Mr. Chairman, they do. They strip the private the option to use a private facility from the bill, so it would essentially stay the same way it is now with a commitment to only use public facilities in other states. That would be other state DOCs or other public entities like counties that we could contract with.
Okay, thank you. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Williams, I always get concerned when I'm looking at a bill or an amendment that says strips out the section, but I haven't had a chance to go look at the section that's getting stripped out. Does this will this have a sunset on it? That will, or does this get rid of the sunset and give you this authority permanently?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Shields, the bill does remove the sunset out of the language and makes it just a permanent authorization to use out-of-state public rental beds if necessary.
You know, I think there hasn't been. I'm not sure that we're going to get to a place where we're actually going to make any significant changes to slow the growth of our prison system. We're now spending about $1.6 billion. So I would be inclined to give the department this authority because we might not have much choice in the matter, frankly. But I would hope that when we get it over to the Senate, you might consider putting back in that sunset so that we could revisit this 4 or 5 years down the road.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, obviously, you know, would be amenable to a sunset. What we never want to happen from an administrator standpoint is to be caught without the authority to be able to do this if we needed to. But I don't think we'd have an objection to a sunset. I think longer than 2 years probably makes sense. But this sunset, we went from 2003 to 2009, so it was about a six-year period before it sunsetted. And I'm grateful to say in that period of time we have never had to use it. And it's certainly not in our current population management plan to suggest that we would.
Okay, thank you. And we appreciate your not wanting to move people out of state. It's there, our people, and I like to see through under your direction because we don't know always what goes on other places, especially in the private industry. Thank you very much, Director. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Williams. Mary Botkin, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. And we have actually been up here many times on the use of out-of-state private prisons and encouraging the committee not to do this. And, in fact, it was because of Max when he was a member of the chamber that we were able to stop the use of private prisons out-of-state. And we have been successful in not allowing the use of private prisons in state either. I want to say that while we don't think that out-of-state housing is ever a great idea for the inmates because of the loss of family connections, we also understand the need for the department to have some flexibility, and we are prepared to support the amendments as proposed by the department. And we think that this provides some flexibility that we may need, and I agree with Representative Shields. I don't know where we're going with inmate populations or with prison construction, but I know that overcrowded, understaffed prisons are dangerous places for inmates and staff, and it's not the way the department wants to run its business. But in a budget crisis, there's going to be very few options and very little flexibility. So this will at least give them some flexibility, and hopefully we won't have to use it very much. Hopefully we'll figure out a way to lower the crime rate.
Thank you.
Any
questions for me? Thank you very much, Ms. Botkin. I'd accept a motion to adopt the dash threes.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments into House Bill 2292.
Representative Krieger moves the Dastry amendments into House Bill 2292. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And close the public hearing. We'll close the public hearing. We'll carry that over to Monday.
Were we in a public hearing or a work session?
We were in a public hearing. Thank you. After we do that, we'll open a work session.
Sorry.
And I will let it back open.
Yes. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2292.
Dash 3, excuse me.
It's a long week. Yes, it has been. Representative Krieger moves the Dash 3s into House Bill 2292. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none. Supporter, close the work session and open a public and carry it till Monday. Thank you. Now, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3348.
House Bill 3348
authorizes special agents employed by governor to apply for search warrants and sign a judge's name on a duplicate original warrant, declares an emergency. And again, we do not yet have the fiscal back on this.
Okay. Bacon Blitz, Sharon Harmon, and Morgan Gunther. We're in favor. Everybody's in favor of this bill, so I would appreciate it if we could summarize. We've got still have quite a schedule to go, but I don't want you to cut short anything that needs to be said.
Chairman Barker, I promise to be unduly brief for lawyers. Chairman Barker, members of the committee, I am Aiken Blitz. I'm a third-generation Oregonian, a lawyer who practices with the Bullard Law Firm in Portland, Oregon, and a trustee of the Oregon Humane Society. I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 3348. The bill simply adds governor special agents to the list of those who may apply for search warrants. As a trustee, I'm here to assure you of several key points that are critical to the success and continued success of the Oregon Humane Society. First of all, I'd like to share a personal reason for my support and my belief that this bill represents good law. Two cases that I have been involved in my career, first as a police officer and then as a lawyer, touched me profoundly. The first occurred in the 1970s here in Salem when I was a deputy sheriff with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. It involved horrific sex abuse of a 1.5-year-old girl. The second case arose in Coos County when a deputy sheriff ran against his boss, and I was involved in effecting his termination when charges of physical abuse, sexual abuse, and emotional abuse concerning his daughter came to light. There was commonality in those two cases, and the commonality was serious violence and abuse, cruelty to animals that was documented in both of those cases. OHS has a long history of cruelty enforcement. We have accomplished this organizational mission dating back to 1881 when the Oregon Humane Society was recognized by the state of Oregon as a guardian of children and animals. And we have engaged in this with private funds and with law enforcement authority at various times afforded by the governor, the Multnomah County Sheriff, Portland Police Department and others, or Portland Police Bureau and others. The Humane Society is committed to its cruelty cases and its law enforcement unit, and we're committed to do that long-term without public money. In doing this, we work closely and collaboratively with Oregon's sheriffs and police departments.
We have expert and highly trained cruelty investigators. We have a medical staff at the Humane Society, and the Humane Society enjoys a deep network of support of material and volunteers that we can bring to bear in these cases. We are committed as an organization to do what we do in support of the criminal justice system and the law enforcement community in close cooperation with local law enforcement, and we do that in all of these cases, particularly with regard to the execution of search warrants. Finally, if I may, and in conclusion, I'd like to share that I discussed this bill last week in Eugene at the annual conference of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and found that the chiefs in the audience were surprised that the humane agents could not now apply for warrants. They viewed House Bill 3348 as what they referred to as a housekeeping measure, and an obvious consensus of the group led to Kevin Campbell submitting Chairman Barker to you and to the committee OACP's letter of endorsement. Todd Anderson has spoken in support for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and Chairman Barker, if I may convey to you and the committee through the committee assistant, a letter that was delivered to me this morning by Josh Marquis, the district attorney for Clatsop County, who has prosecuted a number of cruelty cases and can vouch for the professionalism of our humane agents. This bill will avoid, as Josh Marquis points out, what is frankly a waste of time and inconvenience driven by our humane agents, who are experts, sitting down and having a police officer, a detective in a police department, parrot what they've seen and what they've concluded as the experts in a search warrant affidavit. So it will, in fact, streamline these investigations and enable our agents and local law enforcement to get to the scene and get to work as police officers in a much more expeditious fashion. Chairman Barker, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'd introduce Sharon Harmon, our executive director.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Blitz, rather.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Harmon, executive director for the Oregon Humane Society. Point of clarification, we are not affiliated with any local or national nonprofit or other association. They just have a bigger name than we do. We are the Oregon Humane Society, established in 1868. We have a long history of advocacy for animals in Oregon. We were part of the team that put the animal cruelty laws in the books. When the state was very young, we began enforcement of those laws in 1881, and we continue today to do so. You might be asking, why are we here today to clarify within the law our ability to seek search warrants? We have had this ability for many years, but there is ambiguity with our commission under the governor's through the governor's office under an equally old statute that empowers us as humane agents. And it is not clear in the statutes whether we do have that authority. We have exercised that authority for many years. We have voluntarily stopped until this matter was settled. We're here today to ask you to clarify it and put our officers back in the street protecting animals and providing services to law enforcement agencies around the state. Our humane agents are uniquely positioned. They are experts at animal crimes, and we have the ability to walk a case through from start to finish. Our shelter is state-of-the-art. It's the largest in the state, and it's nationally recognized. Our veterinary team provides services not only to the animals in our cases, but to those animals in other jurisdictions' cases. We provide a wide variety of services to the state of Oregon, and as Mr. Blitz mentioned, it is at no cost to the state. You will not find us here asking for money. This bill doesn't have any fiscal impact in terms of we're adding anything new. We're just clarifying the law, put our officers back in the streets with their search warrants, working in conjunction with local law enforcement. And you'll hear from one of our investigators and from our chief veterinarian more of the details. We know the link between human abuse and animal abuse is real and convincing. We are here today to continue to provide that service. Often our investigators are first responders. People are far more likely to report animal abuse than child abuse. Whether you agree with that system of priorities, we agree that we're glad to be in the field advocating for the welfare of children and animals. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Venter.
Thank you, Representative Barker, Chair Barker, and the committee. My name is Morgan Guthner. I'm the livestock deputy for the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. I investigate all the animal crimes in the county. I come here, my boss, Sheriff Craig Roberts, and the Oregon Sheriff's Association asked me to come down today and support this bill. I investigate animal crimes for full-time for the sheriff's office, which is pretty rare in the state of Oregon. Most law enforcement agencies do not have the manpower or the money to have a full-time investigator. I work with the Humane Society investigators on several search warrants in Clackamas County. They are a professional organization, and I'm happy to come down here and show my support for this bill.
Thank you very much for taking time to do that. Representative Stegler.
Yeah, I just want to comment. And I appreciate you pointing out earlier, Mr. Blitz, that a lot of people don't realize that the Oregon Humane Society started out with a dual purpose. And it was a rather strange, quite strange commentary that it was animals and children. But it's true. They were the first frontline folks back then.
Question. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the present time, when your special agents are going to exercise a warrant, do you have a police officer with you?
Chairman Barker, Representative Krieger, at all times when we execute a warrant, we are working in close conjunction with local law enforcement. Because our officers are currently unarmed, and there's really only two of us in the field right now, we need all the cooperation, and so we work in conjunction. They are always on site when we issue a search warrant. It is with local jurisdiction's approval that we apply for search warrants.
Just a comment. I was concerned because you have to have reason to believe to get the search warrant. And then if a police officer goes and while exercising a warrant, he sees some evidence of another crime, he has certain things that he can do, and there's a process before he can move into that other issue. And if you don't have them with you, I was wondering whether your people were trained to understand how to do that. But if you've got someone with you when you serve the warrants, then that no longer would be a concern.
Chairman Barker, Representative Krieger, in fact, law enforcement often uses the animal complaint as a way to get into the residence. Because there's an existing complaint, they don't have probable cause on the other issue. We work hand in hand with local law enforcement. Animal abuse is not a crime in isolation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Barker and members of the committee, my name is Bonnie Helzer. I'm a special agent for the Oregon Humane Society. I am honored to be here to address and support House Bill 3348. I have 6 years in the past of full-time law enforcement experience. I was a patrol officer, traditional patrol officer, before I came here to the Humane Society. Our special agents have successfully served search warrants in the past with success, honor, and integrity. I have served them myself personally in my traditional role as a police officer prior to my special agent duties. In collaboration with other agencies, our ability to serve search warrants is integral to our dependability and professionalism. Agencies call on us due to their lack of resources. We need to be able to handle these requests from start to finish. Without the ability to write search warrants and to swear to search warrants, we lose credibility. Why call us in to help if we can't finish the job? When I was a traditional police officer, I didn't have time to do a lot of the animal crimes. I was working persons crimes. We at special agents want to work the animal crimes. That's our passion, so we need to be allowed to do that to assist these other agencies. We are a voice for feeling creatures who can't speak, and search warrants are often the only chance to save the animal from a cruel environment. I would encourage the support of HB 3348 for us to be allowed to do the job the way we've always done it, with expertise, knowledge, and compassion.
Thank you very much.
Representative Barker, new members of the committee, my name is Dr. Chris Ottoman. I'm chief veterinarian at the Oregon Humane Society, and I serve on the faculty at Oregon State University. In order to expedite and be brief, some of the main points have been made. I'd like to focus primarily on our opportunity at Oregon Humane Society to collaborate with law enforcement in crimes that relate to humans and animals. The Oregon Humane Society special agents and veterinarians like myself collaborate continually on cases that involve interpersonal violence, which we all know is linked to animal abuse and violence. There's always an animal component, or often an animal component, when there's a human component. In the past year, I've testified on two cases in which law enforcement from Washington County have presented deceased pets to me for autopsy and evidence collection. Both of these pets were killed by individuals who were on trial for violent crimes against their domestic partners. In both of these cases, the individuals were convicted of aggravated animal abuse for maliciously killing an animal. Search warrant service was essential in these cases. Certainly our collaboration and cooperation was essential with local law enforcement. And this is again why Oregon needs House Bill 3348, so that we can clear up the and make the collaboration and communication complete. I appreciate your time and the opportunity to testify, and I have a copy of my testimony here for you.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry.
My question, I don't know if anyone perhaps from the governor's office is planning to testify, but I would have a couple questions. If
this is the last of the people testifying.
I'm wondering if Mr. O'Leary would be so inclined. Apologies. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Mr. O'Leary, I sorry to call you up like that. I first of all, I support this bill. But I recognize that it is a power that we are delegating to the governor to essentially appoint these special agents who then have these rights. I'm wondering, and this works very well, provided the governor, whoever that might be, use that with prudently and with discretion, and only, for example, deputized, for lack of a better word, trained agents. I'm wondering if you could tell me what the process in place now currently is, assuming to ensure that we only have trained professionals who have this power.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, for the record, Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski. Representative Barton, the answer to your question is that the governor already has the power to appoint special agents under the governor's commission. It is a power that's exercised in very, very limited circumstances. In fact, I believe humane agents that are the subject of this bill is the only exercise of that power.
Perhaps railroad agents?
Excuse me?
Railroad agents, perhaps, Mr. O'Leary?
I don't believe there are any that have been appointed representative. And as to the specific process, I would have to punt to our general counsel, Kelly Sky, whose portfolio that lives in. I'm not familiar with the exact process, but I know that this is, and I'd like to, since I left the safety of my office where I was watching this hearing, to come up to the room to kind of give a little thumbs up from our office. I would like to use the opportunity to express that, you know, this is a bill that the governor is supportive of, and it's obviously because these agents work under a governor's commission, it is in our office's interest to make sure that those agents are performing the duties that are expected of them in a lawful way and as authorized by statutes. And to the extent there is an ambiguity, reasonable minds may disagree, but we'd encourage you to clarify that through this bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any further questions?
Sorry about that. Okay.
Thank you. Close these. House Bill 3348. I'm going to kind of go out of order here. We're going to go back to House Bill 3394. I just was handed the witness sheet, and there were three people who had signed up who we didn't give a chance to speak earlier. I'd call first. I'd like to hear from Brian Henson, and then Jeff Martin and Derek Bliss, please. I apologize for that slip up there. You go first. I think that'd be
sure. What I prefer. Chair Barker, representatives of the committee, my name is Brian Henson. I'm here as the prior program manager for the private security program with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, a position that I held from December of 2002 until March 2009, just this earlier this month. So I want to just bring to the committee a few points as far as the program's administration and the effects of House Bill 3394 on our administration, and then Jeff Martin, who's the chair of the Private Security Policy Committee, will talk about the policy committee and board processes and how those play into minimum standards and training. And then, as I understand it, we have a member of the private security community here as well to speak to you. I have provided written testimony to you today. I'm going to paraphrase that because you have that in front of you, but I want to hit the highlights. The purpose of the Private Security Certification Licensing Program is to administer the Private Security Service Providers Act. And basically, this means making sure that the standards that are established by the board and the Private Security Policy Committee have been met before we administer or issue a license or certification. Today, we have about 16,000 active private security professionals in the state of Oregon, and we process about 575 applications a week within our a month within our program to keep that program running. And it is the licensing certification fees that pay for this program. These fees are paid primarily by the applicants for certification, but there are also a number of models out there where businesses assist in that, or businesses pay them up front and then take them back out of their pay later. House Bill 3394 would expand and create new workload issues centered on training and curriculum development and investigatory processes. These additional duties, responsibilities would increase the workload associated within the unit, and it would result in increased licensing fees paid by these applicants for licensure. Today, the program is not adequately staffed to address the increased workload added by House Bill 3394, which would mandate that an investigation be conducted by the department, that any investigation conducted by the department shall be closed within 7 days. Timely, careful, high-quality work must be a priority. The length of time an investigation is open must be dependent upon the fact-finding process itself, not on the specified timeline. To shortcut the process would not be fair to the individual subject to the investigation, and it would likely result in increased potential for costly litigation. 7 days, which equates to 5 working days, is not a sufficient amount of time to conduct a fair, impartial, and legally defensible investigation when you consider we're located here in Salem, our constituency is across the state of Oregon, and we also serve 3,000 individuals nationwide. House Bill 3394 does mandate additional training hours and specific subject matter. The program is currently insufficiently staffed to take on and perform the tasks associated with the review, analysis, development, and implementation of a large-scale curriculum change for our providers. These processes would need to be completed and implemented by January 1st, 2010. And the duties, functions necessary to address the curriculum needs associated with these increased training standards are outside the scope of the duties and qualifications of the program's current staff.
It is the goal of the private security program and the policy committee to at all times increase the professionalism of the industry and the individual officers within it. It is the directive of the department and the private security policy committee to evaluate and assess and reestablish standards and training needs, and to do so in collaboration with the private security industry in Oregon. DPSST cannot implement the provisions of House Bill 3394 with our current budget. DPSST is also concerned about the fiscal impact and the operational impact these changes will have on the small businesses that comprise the majority of Oregon's private security industry. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Martin. I'm here representing the private security industry as chair of the Private Security Policy Committee, and I too will also give an abbreviated report. You have my entire testimony in print in front of you. The Private Security Services Providers Act, or PSSPA, was established in 1995, was implemented at the request of the private security industry, seeking self-imposed regulation in the form of a state-administered licensing and certification program.
Yes.
Specifically, ORS 181.630, Section C, states the board and department on public safety standards and training shall support collaboration among public and private security organizations with whom they work and the interests of the committees or the communities in which they serve. House Bill 3394 would implement changes to standards, training, and curriculum without consultation with the board and in absence of industry participation, contrary to the collective interest of the private security community. During the 2005 legislative session, under Senate Bill 61, there was constraining language around required hours of training and specific subject matter which were repealed, and instead, provisions to define that training and curriculum standards through the Oregon Administrative Rule were given to the board. House Bill 3394 mandates required training hours, curriculum content, and curriculum delivery for all segments of the industry. The changes proposed in HB 3394 will impact the ability of the policy committee, the board, and DPSST to respond to industry trends and meet the needs of our constituents. It also should be noted that HB 3394 impacts local criminal justice agencies by mandating that portions of the curriculum be taught by law enforcement officers. The training provisions suggested under HB 3394 are imposed unilaterally and return to statute mandated training hours and curriculum subjects. House Bill 3394 mandates additional hours of basic classroom instruction. We recognize the importance of relevant, reoccurring, and responsive training, but there must be a balance between what is defined as a minimum requirement for certification or licensure and that training which is job specific. In January of 2009, after a culmination of 3-year curriculum development project, the board approved revised curriculum for armed private security professionals. House Bill 3394 would reduce the initial armed classroom training requirement from 24 to 16 hours. If passed, this bill would negate the work by subject matter experts and create a statutory mandate for required training hours. By implementing House Bill 3394, regulatory burdens will be increased. The cost of business and administration will increase significantly, and the flexibility of the Private Security Services Providers Act today will be reduced. I would like to add that prior to the introduction of this bill, the Private Security Policy Committee had no knowledge of this bill, and the creators of the bill did not come before the Private Security Policy Committee, which is the venue available to them for bringing these issues to our attention. As soon as I was made aware of the bill, I immediately sent a letter to the crafters of this bill and requested that they attend our next committee meeting. You have a copy of that letter also in front of you. I invited their comments and am willing to work with them to see what their needs are. Separate from my role as the policy committee chair and in my role as operating a private security alarm monitoring central station in Oregon, I ask that you do not support House Bill 3394 and instead let the issues proposed therein be handled and addressed through the processes already working and in place today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members of the board, Chairman, Representative Barker. Good afternoon. My name is Derek Bliss, CPP. It's a certified protection professional, meaning board certified in security management. I currently hold the position of branch manager for First Response. While working with this company for 10 years and in the industry for 19 years, I have maintained my DPSST armed and unarmed certification and executive manager license for the majority of these years. I've seen the industry grow and establish a professional image we can be proud of. To help establish credibility, a passion, and understanding for the security industry, I'll set a foundation for my testimony. I obtained a BA in criminal justice from Western Oregon University. For 4 years, I've served as the ARM representative on the Private Security Policy Committee and chairing that ARM subcommittee for 4 years. I currently serve as a regional vice president for ASIS. ASIS International is a preeminent organization for security professionals with more than 34,000 members worldwide. Although I do not represent ASIS here today, I do bring a diverse background with professional experience. And you've heard from the DPSST, the agency views. You've heard from the views of the Private Security Investigator Policy Committee and the important role of the Policy Committee, which is which the legislative body put in place. The high standards, the higher standards is a great idea. However, we must let the process work to have a finished product which works. Unarmed curriculum is currently under review, and with that, it's going through a very formal process, and through that process, there might be the opportunity to increase the hours through that, but there's a process currently in place that maybe the authors of this bill weren't aware of that might increase the hours, even to more than what they were proposing. The impact on the industry is pretty great. It creates lower standards for armed professionals and a future burden for professional advancement in the future by removing specific training hours from Oregon Administrative Rule, again, back to statute. So it doesn't give us that flexibility to adjust to industry needs. This would take our industry two steps back, and if the goal is to create the ability to provide professional growth, this would truly be counterproductive. Imagine if you, the Judiciary Board, were not afforded the opportunity to hear public testimony, and a fairly new department stated things have changed and the public will not be afforded the opportunity to have all the constituents input on future matters, and it just got passed and went right by you folks. It's the same type of feeling I have here. By passing this bill, we'd be doing the same thing that the Private Security Investigator Policy Committee is charged with doing. I want to focus on the impact on business and our business. Our company was in place before the Private Security Act in 1995. We say the standards, we felt the standards would help build what we have today. This does not promote what we have spent, over 14 years building since 1995. The impact on our business, our company was in place before this, but we understand the importance of standards. In fact, the owner of our company was one of the five or six representatives of the private security industry that went to the state to ask for regulation. So no one knows professionalism probably more than the founder of our company, where how we represent our company, how we dress, how we represent our industry is also important to us. We know how we look and how we present ourselves not only represents our company but our industry, and we take a look at this everywhere we go, whether we're speaking here or in front of a different body, a different group of people. The other thing is, one of the goals of the Private Security Investigators Policy Committee is to improve the industry's image with law enforcement. And House Bill 3394 puts an unnecessary strain on law enforcement with their time, and our company would experience a huge financial burden from increased costs paying for their time that we don't currently have. Even if this did make sense, imagine if our company was to unable to obtain a law enforcement officer to perform these certain portions of the curriculum. This would create more of an inconvenience than we already have, but would also limit our ability to grow and adapt quickly to our client and community security needs, waiting for an outside agency to come in and train. The number one priority for law enforcement is not training my people. Here's the questions I would be asking if I were in your positions. Getting testimony from law enforcement and what their feelings about this. What other feedback has the Private Security Investigative Policy Committee got from other constituents? Have they received any other testimony via phone in favor of this or opposed to this? Having the opportunity to serve as the chair of the Armed Subcommittee for 4 years
a group of private security professionals and law enforcement professionals spent over 3 years reaching out to our constituents across the state, promoting professionalism, a higher standard for armed for security professionals, and the new curriculum was well received by security professionals around the state and law enforcement. 24 hours is the amount of time needed for this curriculum, and it is confusing to me why we'd want to lower the standards in one area and promote the possible growth in another, taking away from a process which works. And I brought that curriculum with me. It's actually not for to be submitted at this time. But so lastly is, you know, an increase on basic training from 8 to 32 hours of classroom is going to cost about $600 per applicant, $60,000 per year for a company of our size. Estimated fiscal impact on the bill for DPSSG administrative staff is about, I think it's provided to you, $316,000. Not passing HB 3394, priceless. I'd be certainly open to entertain any questions you might have.
Any questions? Thank you, panel, and I apologize for having the delay in your time to get up there. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3394. Open a work session on House Bill 2139. Okay.
Chairman, I'm Sequini. House Bill 2139 comes in from the DHS. It allows the Director of Human Services to file a petition to appoint a trustee of a long-term care facility without giving notice to the owner if there's a serious and immediate risk of harm to the patients. Chair, members of the committee, our last meeting we adopted the Dash 5 amendments. The bill is all ready to go. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee, but that has been removed. We sent the letter from the Speaker. So the only thing left to do is, because it has no fiscal, the money they raise will offset it.
Okay, no fiscal. All right. Is there any discussion? Ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2139 as adopted to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Stigler moves House Bill 2139 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excuse?
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Excuse.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. We put that on the consent. Does anybody feel we need to explain that one? Okay, that goes on the consent calendar. Close the work session. Open a work session on House Bill 2713. Which one is yours?
Mine is 2335, Mr. Chairman of the committee.
Okay, we'll go ahead. I'll close that at 2713. We'll go to House Bill 2335.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee. House Bill 2335 comes in from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. You have the Dash 5 amendments, which are hot off the press today. We have Darian Stanford here, Bronson James, and Steve Powers all here to explain the amendments. What we're dealing with is the how often you must have a parole hearing after a parole hearing. Is it, the person has had a hearing and it's been denied. It basically applies to several different situations, one with murder, one the pre-1989 cases, and then the other one is the persons who are defined to be a dangerous offenders. But I would suggest that you bring those parties up here for discussion on the amendments.
Okay. If we could have those parties come forward, please. Any order, just identify yourself.
I guess I'm up front. I'll start. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Darian Stanford. I'm a deputy district attorney with Multnomah County, and I'm down here to appear in support of House Bill 2335, as written in the Dash 5 amendments. And as you'll recall, there was an earlier public hearing about this bill, and there was testimony taken, and there were a couple of questions that were asked. One was asked by Representative Barton relating to specificity of findings that the board would need to make, and another question was asked by Representative Garrett relating to interim hearings. Council, Shannon Savelle, said that accurately summarized the bill for you. You'll recall that the whole point of this bill, all we're talking about, is right now any class of offender that would appear before the parole board, if they're denied parole, hearing, whatever the appropriate term, there are different terms for hearing, change in circumstances, etc. Every 2 years you get a re-review. All this bill does is to say, at the discretion of the board, that can be 2 years or can be as far as 10 years. The issue that came up had to do with the constitutionality of this bill, specifically under the ex post facto clause of, I believe there's one in the Oregon Constitution as well as the United States Constitution. Just generally, for the most obvious application of ex post facto would be criminalizing something that's not presently criminal and applying it retroactively. So you all could, if you wanted to, pass a bill today making it illegal to wear a pink shirt on a Friday, and I'd be in trouble. But the ex post facto clause would protect me, hopefully.
Not a bad idea, Mr. Chair.
Not a bad idea. Thank you. So in any event, that's the most simple application of ex post facto. And here, the question that the Supreme Court has said is, what the controlling inquiry in an ex post facto determination is, does retroactive application of whatever this law, the proposed law is, does it create a sufficient risk of increasing punishment? That's the question that we need to answer. And just what I want to do is just take a moment to talk about the constitutionality, and I'll talk then about the two specific changes that the Dash 5 amendments add. After the last hearing, I worked with Bronson James, seated here to my left, and to address, can we come to an agreement in terms of making this bill constitutional? Well, there are some things that ultimately you can get really close on, but you're not going to agree at the end of the day, yes it is, yes it isn't, or no it isn't. I'd say in some ways we're close, and we're a lot closer than we ever have been, and I think the Dash 5 amendments give us the very best shot, and in my personal opinion, it is constitutional. Mr. James has a different opinion, and he can address that, but this is a far better version. So there are two things, then, that this bill does differently, the Dash 5 amendment. And so let me take just a second to talk about those. The first thing relates to, let me talk about Representative Barton's question about specific findings. Well, what findings does the board have to make to extend something beyond the two-year period? What this Dash 5 does is it now tells the board, this is what you need to find. And what it is for murderers, remember there are three classes of offenders that appear before the board generally, murderers. In order to grant parole to somebody, or what would the actual correct term be?
Finder, that they're likely to be rehabilitated.
Yeah, okay. For parole, if the board's going to extend a hearing beyond 2 years, they need now, under this version, to make a specific finding that this inmate is not reasonably likely to be rehabilitated within the next 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years. They need to make that specific finding. That's the standard that would be used to decide whether or not they're going to be getting parole anyway. So that specific finding would need to be made by them, by the board. And that idea comes from one of the United States Supreme Court cases, I believe it was the Georgia case, where in upholding the change in law that Georgia did, in finding it constitutional, the United States Supreme Court said one thing that we liked about this provision, this law, is that the board was already finding, you know what, it's not really likely that the person was going to have gotten parole anyway. So if they're not likely to have been paroled anyway, how is there an increase of punishment? How is there a risk of increased punishment? There's not. They weren't going to be getting parole to begin with. That's the standard for murderers. That's in Section 1 of the Dash 5s. For matrix offenders, those that committed crimes prior to November 1st of 1989, it's same, except the language is different. To be granting parole to matrix offenders,
the standard is, does the person have a severe emotional disturbance such as to constitute a danger to the community? Well, if the board is going to set a subsequent hearing beyond the two-year period, they're going to need to find, you know what, it's not reasonable to expect that, insert the appropriate language, within the next few years. That's the standard for matrix offenders. Same principle then for dangerous offenders. The dash 5 version requires the board to make the specific finding that, you know what, you weren't going to be getting out anyway in the requisite time period. That idea comes from a question that Representative Barton has, and it specifically ties into one of the findings of the United States Supreme Court in upholding a similar law. The second aspect, though, of the bill, of the dash 5 amendments that enhances its constitutionality greatly, has to do with the question that Representative Garrett had about an interim review period. Well, what happens if the board says, we're going to set this out 10 years? So in 2010, the board denies parole, and they decide, you know what, it's not likely that you're going to be rehabilitated. We're going for the next 10 years. So the next hearing is in 2020. Representative Garrett had a question about what happens if circumstances change somehow. If something happens, how can the board rescind that? Can the board undo their decision? Now, in the dash 5 amendments, there is such a provision. Every 2 years, the inmate, whether they're a dangerous offender, matrix offender, whatever, they have the right to say, hey, you should consider me, even though you set my hearing out for 10 years, you should consider me. And here's why. There's been a change. It is no longer true that I'm not likely to be rehabilitated, and here's why. So that is now written into the bill. Why that is important, when you look at it from a constitutional ex post facto analysis, right now under existing law, persons get the right to this hearing every 2 years. With House Bill 2335, you are still going to have the right to have your matter considered every 2 years. The only difference is the board may have made a finding that it's not likely that you're going to be granted it and extended the time with an actual hearing. But every 2 years, you're going to be getting the same rights. So with these provisions, I believe that this is a constitutional bill. It's a small change to existing parole board policy to say from 2 years to 10 years. That's it. We're not changing the substance. It's just the time frame. It's a very small change, but it's a very important change. It's a very significant change for victims. You'll notice behind me, Tiffany Edens has taken the time off of work to show up today. At the last hearing, there were other victims, and these are people that have to go through the hell of reliving what happened to them every 2 years in front of the parole board, and I don't think that that's necessary, and this bill addresses that concern in a manner that's constitutional.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, please.
Thank you, Representative Barker, members of the committee. My name is Bronson James. I'm Chief Deputy Defender at Oregon's Office of Public Defense Services. Mr. Sanford and I and Mr. Taylor and others did go away from our last session, and we put some ideas together, and a lot of the ideas that we put out are incorporated in this dash 5 amendment. So to the extent that Darian is saying that this is a better bill than the first version, I completely agree. There are strides taken forward. Whether it is ultimately constitutional or not, quite frankly, is going to be an open question. I can give you my opinion on that and to where deficiencies in the bill as it is right now may currently lie. The thing that I want to very carefully outline for the committee now, and I think I did this in my previous testimony, although I think maybe I didn't do it sufficiently, and you have these conversations and so many times and to so many different people, you kind of forget who you talk to, and I think maybe I didn't make this as clear before, but it's very important to understand how Oregon's parole statutes work, because they function very strangely, and they are not the same as Georgia's parole statutes or California's parole statutes, or for that matter, just about anybody else's parole statutes. Unlike Georgia, for instance, where there was a presumption of continued incarceration. So in there, when a parole hearing, the way a parole hearing was structured in that case, the inmate bears a burden of proof and persuasion, and they must prove their rehabilitation to the board. If they don't do so, their incarceration is presumed to continue. Oregon is flip-flopped in that respect. And with respect to dangerous offenders and
Matrix offenders, or pre-1989 Matrix offenders, we have a flip-flop version where the presumption is release. And so the inmates in these hearings have no burden of proof and no burden of persuasion. And so it's more accurate, rather than to think of these parole hearings as something where an inmate comes and tries to establish that he should be released, there's something that the board convenes on a regularly scheduled basis. For instance, I mean, the inmate doesn't petition to have these hearings. The board schedules them because the board gathers these inmates together and establishes a factual record. This is very similar to like a civil inquest where the board is both the fact finder and then the ultimate announcer of a decision and determines if continued incarceration can be justified. And the statutes are written, say, for instance, these pre-1989 Matrix offenders, that unless the inmate has a present severe emotional disturbance, the presumption is that they will be released. And unless the board makes the finding that they do have a present severe emotional disturbance, that inmate needs to be released. And so, you know, Darian is right in the general notion of how ex post facto works, but I mean, ex post facto is a very complicated area, and what we're talking about, and when we're talking about these hearings, we're all in agreement that we're talking about a procedural mechanism. And how ex post facto works when you're talking about a procedural mechanism gets really kind of thorny. But basically what it is if you have a procedural change that affects a substantive right, and it affects that substantive right in such a manner as there is an increased likelihood of punitive result, then you have an ex post facto problem. Well, the Oregon Supreme Court has already, in case law, interpreted our parole statutes to say that there is a substantive right to release under these Matrix offenders and then the dangerous offenders. There's a different statutory scheme for murderer, so I'm setting those aside for a minute. So what we have here is a procedural change to what our own state Supreme Court has already determined is a substantive right. The question then is, this is the question that a court ultimately would ask. If the board has to convene under the current rules, has to convene itself every 2 years to justify its continued incarceration under the way these statutes work, if the board now doesn't have to justify that continued incarceration except every 10 years, is there an increased likelihood that that has a punitive result? It's an open question. I think it's a pretty good, you know, there's good arguments on both sides. I can assure you it would be litigated. That's all I can tell you at the end of the day. And I do think, you know, I'm in no way in the business of predicting what the Supreme Court does on anything. And so I can't tell you if it would be ex post facto or not. But I can say that there are good arguments on both sides. And there is legitimate reason for concern. So turning then to the Dash 5 as it is written, if the committee wants to proceed under this amendment, as I said, there are a number of changes that have been added in. I think those are good. And they're a step in improving the bill and, you know, at the end of the day, maybe helping it survive constitutional attack. There are still a few things that differentiate it from some of these other California, Georgia statutes, et cetera. As I mentioned before, those other statutes were crime-specific. Both of those were murder only. This statute still addresses the entire release authority of the board, which Mr. Powers can give you numbers, but I think it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,600 individuals, and ranges from crimes from murder to various sex crimes to these 1989 and earlier Matrix offenders, which, you know, can be a potpourri of various crimes on the books there. So that's one difference that still exists within the bill as it is. While the bill as written does certainly say that the board has to make a finding to justify setting the hearing beyond 2 years, one thing that is missing that might be helpful is what the evidentiary standard is to make that finding. Does the board have to find that the a new hearing would not be needed by a preponderance? Is it clear and convincing evidence? The bill is silent to that effect, so that's something you may wish to consider as well. Third, there's still also no provision in the bill for any requirement for specific and articulated reasonings set forth by the board to justify extending beyond 2 years. And it's, again, it's also important for the committee to recognize that board orders in this respect, board action forms, are not very lengthy. A couple of sentences is very typical. And so, you know, some sort of provision where the board is required to set forth in perhaps some greater degree of detail why it feels setting these hearings beyond 2 years, again, might be something worth considering for you. The other thing that I think I would recommend the committee talk to Mr. Powers about, because I think he's better suited to this, but it's something I don't know the answer to, but I have a question about, is whether under the current interim hearing provision under the bill, so the inmate can petition for an interim hearing every 2 years, whether the act of petitioning for the interim hearing would trigger the board's responsibilities to notify the victims and seek victim input. Because if the purpose of this bill is to sort of decrease the frequency of that, then, you know, that's something that I think the committee should consider. The other thing I want to point out here in closing is that you've heard a lot of debate and dispute about whether there may be some sort of constitutional infirmity with this bill. But the one thing that I guarantee you would erase any constitutional infirmity of this bill is to simply not make it retroactive. If this bill only applied to murderers and dangerous offenders and sexually violent dangerous offenders whose crime commission was on the effective date of the bill, not only is there no constitutional infirmity to litigate, there's no litigation because no lawyer would file such a case. It would be deemed frivolous. The very nature of ex post facto is that it only applies to retroactive application. So, there is, and I believe me, I understand that applying something only prospectively doesn't target many of the people who the district attorney's office are championing this bill for, but it certainly does protect all future victims stretching out off into the future. And that is an absolute guaranteed way to erase any constitutional problem with this bill. And it's also, and we haven't seen a fiscal, I don't think, from this bill, it's also a surefire way to defer any potential fiscal impact for about 15 years. So, and at that point, if the committee has any questions.
Okay. Representative Garrett.
Mr. Chair, a couple comments. Sounds like a lot of good thought has gone into this. I appreciate the testimony and the Dash 5s. They address a lot of the practical problems that we discussed in the last hearing. I guess on the last few points that you made, Bronson, were those issues discussed among you and rejected, and if so, maybe Darian could speak to why. The other point I'd make, Mr. Chair, is I spoke to Kevin Neely before the hearing about the possibility of obtaining a legislative council opinion on constitutionality. I would feel better proceeding if we had that, and I don't know if that's something we're still... Have you talked to Kevin about that?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, spoke with Kevin Neely and with Josh Nasby, with Legislative Council, and I believe I didn't hear a yes. I will, but I would anticipate that that's something that would a request that would need to come from Council or from a member. Actually, I believe
Council
Chairman of the Committee. I had discussion with Josh Nasby about this, and we both he looked at the Georgia case and the California case, and I did too. And I looked at it, but I don't think either one of us knew that the Oregon law, the board bears the burden of proof, and in Georgia, the person seeking parole does. And that could be a, a significant distinction between the two. So neither one of us analyzed it in light of that. If you look at the way that Georgia does it and California does it, and if we had the same similar statute, we'd obviously be okay. But from what I'm hearing, we don't, at least as it relates to parolees who were in there before 1989 and those who were dangerous offenders.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a follow-up question of Bronson?
Please.
If we change the statute saying that prisoners, that the presumption runs in the prisoner's favor, if we change that by statute, I presume you'd have the same ex post facto issues that we were talking about here.
Chairman Parker, Representative Garrett, yes. And in that case, we'd have an ex post facto case that I would feel even stronger about. So it's a solution that creates perhaps more problems than it solves.
I have a question, Mr. James. My assumption is that the statute would, any challenge would be based on its application of the statute to the particular individual.
Chairman Barker, we would have to have a specific application for before we could proceed with appeal. I mean, you'd have to go through the normal appellate process anyway. So there would have to be an application. The individual would challenge that through the administrative review process. Presumably the board would rule against that individual. They would petition for judicial review, and that's where we would go from there.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, Mr. Powers, you may want to address that because my assumption is that the meter would be running on you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Stephen Powers, chairperson of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Counsel Taylor, in addition to the discrete challenge of the board applying this, the board is subject to declaratory actions filed in circuit court, mandamus actions, and so there are other ways to challenge the constitutionality that the board has defended, and you are correct that the meter would be running on us and that we would be responsible for defending the constitutionality, and that would come out of our budget.
Mr. Chair.
I have a series of questions, if I may.
You may.
So, just as a preface, Mr. James, you mentioned four critiques of the bill, and I want to make sure, I would like to actually, first of all, I appreciate the thoughtful critiques of it. The first one, as you discussed, in Oregon, unlike in California and Georgia, we have a presumption of release. Justice Brennan smiles whenever that happens, no doubt. I didn't catch the second point. The third point was that the statute does not require specific, I think, reasoning or rationale within it, which makes me nervous. The fourth one was the question of notification of victims. What was the second point again?
Chairman Barker, Representative Barton, it concerned the bill's applicability to the entire spectrum of
gotcha.
The board's release authority rather than making it crime-specific.
Understood. Thank you. And a question of fact. Perhaps your best, just as a matter of statistics, say a first-time person's eligible for parole, what is the approximate percentage that would be released on, say, first hearing and then 2 years later on second hearing? Ballpark.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, members of the committee, unfortunately there isn't a good statistic out there on that. We've not compiled that kind of statistic, given that each hearing is based on the individual circumstances of the offender. I mean, for those who have practiced in the criminal law area know there are murders and then there are murders, and there are many extenuating circumstances around just the context of the crime or crimes that an offender has committed. Take that and add on, layer on top of that 20-plus years or a significant amount of time in the institution and the different variables of how they've treated their institutional conduct, what they've been doing with themselves, and then a layer on top of that what their future plans are. Evaluating all of that doesn't get you out a good percentage of saying first hearing your chances are X and second hearing your chances are Y. What I will say is that at each hearing, offenders, because they have the opportunity to talk about what the board is considering, and they're looking at the people who are going to make the decision on whether they will ultimately be released into the community or not. They learn from that piece, and so as you might recall, and the other members might recall from my testimony earlier, there is that piece of it.
The reason I ask is, first of all, I understand, indeed, perhaps the limited utility of the statistics, but it was crucial to the court's reasoning in Morales, and then, indeed, it was cited again in Garner. And I would never, even as a courtesy or a function of time, I would never, ever vote yes on a bill that I felt was unconstitutional, regardless of how the importance of it, the time, or your courtesy. I would never, ever do it. I never will do it. It is my opinion. First of all, I think Mr. James makes some colorful arguments, really raising some good questions, and they unquestionably will be litigated, and not frivolous litigation at all. However, it is my sincere opinion that the Dash 5 amendments are constitutional. I guess no one can speak with certainty. That's not my job. But I think it highly probable. And of the four arguments you make, I think you're... the most salient one in terms of ex post facto jurisprudence would be the first one, i.e. in Oregon we have a presumption. And respectfully, you talk a lot about how that is a substantive right, but I don't think whether or not it's substantive or otherwise is necessarily the question under U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence or Oregon jurisprudence from according to my reading, and I concede that you know this jurisprudence better than I. Ultimately, and that's why I do think statistics will be necessary. I recommend you start gathering those statistics, regardless of whether you think they're useful, because I think they will be necessary, actually, in subsequent litigation. And I suppose this is a long way of saying I truly believe this is constitutional, and I don't think that presumption actually... actually, it's a question of fact, but I have not yet received... any indication that Oregon's presumption actually will affect the question, which is the really one, whether or not there's significant risk of prolonging the respondent's incarceration. A few other points, if I may ask you, for example, your third one regarding the reasoning. In Georgia, in the Garner case, the requirement to be reasoning, it doesn't have to be statutory. It can be in the board's regulation and the board's procedure. I don't think the absence of that in this statute will affect the constitutionality of this statute. Unquestionably, the parole board could later take actions and adopt, say, bad procedures that would render it unconstitutional. But that's not going to make this statute facially unconstitutional.
Mayor,
I've been going on a while.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that a failure to have an express statutory requirement for, you know, express findings of fact and conclusions of law by the board is the dispositive issue that makes something unconstitutional or not. You know, the ex post facto argument in this case, and as I said, I'm certainly in no position to tell anybody that it's unconstitutional. I can tell you that there's going to be a good argument to be made, and it's going to be litigated, and the financial burden of litigating that's going to fall on my agency. The other comments were simply along the lines of, you might want to consider this to make this the best bill you want it to be, not necessarily that you need to do these things to make them constitutional. Now, with respect to the requirements for findings by the board, you know, again, that's something that this committee may want to consider adopting in the statute. If this committee has concerns, and I believe that those concerns bubbled up to the surface in our previous hearing about how this board authority would be exercised, when it would be exercised, et cetera, again, as this committee is well aware, you can direct the board very specifically in the statute, and it's up to you to decide if you think that more specific direction may be required in these types. Now, there are statutes in place, for instance, where certain types of board hearings require a greater degree of explanation. So there's statutory precedent from the legislature to require certain extra explanation in certain decision-making processes. That's something I'm just putting out there that you may wish to consider.
A few more. I know I've been going on a while, Mr. Chair, but as you can tell, this is of interest to me. Although your point is, I think, very well taken, and I would like to state that it is imperative that the parole board establish very clear procedures and very clear regulations to implement the statute. Furthermore, I would appreciate it if once that process is done, or indeed as the process is happening, if you would follow up with me, because this is something I, if there is this insufficient clarity or this is not being implemented well, I plan to take that up in the next legislative session. This is a considerable power you have, and it must be done with the utmost clarity. That's point one. Point two, I'd actually like to read some legislative history into the record, if I may. And I'm speaking now. Again, this is Representative Brent Barton, House District 51, and I'm actually speaking directly to the Oregon Court of Appeals. I believe this committee's intent, and certainly my intent in supporting this bill. Or shall I say, it is not my intent that this new parole procedure in any way increase punishment or otherwise impose a greater form of detriment, restraint, or deprivation that is intended primarily to deter the offender and others from committing future criminal acts. That is not what this bill is about. This bill has been intentionally and narrowly crafted to comply with ex post facto jurisprudence, both in Morales and Garner, as well as the Oregon Supreme Court. And this case, of course, is specifically quoting John Lee Smith v. Border Parole, 343 Oregon 410, 2007. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything else?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, again, Steve Powers, the chairperson of the board. The board is neutral on the bill, as I testified at the March hearing, and remains neutral. Again, the board understands the very nature of parole hearings can be highly traumatic to victims and co-victims, but also understands the transformative nature of hearings. We've appreciated the opportunity to work with the proponents and opponents of the bill just on the technical issues, and stand ready to answer any of your questions on how this plays out. I will say that given the complexity of sentencing, even outside of the board's of release authority, with the varying nature of those who are under our release authority, it plays out very differently for depending on which category of offender you're under our release authority. I outlined that in my written testimony. I will refer you back to that. Some have a presumption, some don't. Some need to petition, some don't. Some the board needs to make findings, some don't. What I will answer, just one other piece, is what Mr. James brought up. He asked about the interim hearing provision that's in the Dash 5 amendments. As I understand that, that was modeled after current law, which has an interim hearing procedure under the dangerous offender statute. That's 144.228.1c. That's already been in statute and has been for quite a number of years. The board does not treat that as a full-blown hearing. That the board treats that as a request for a hearing, and therefore the board takes the information that the offender has sent in and file passes that, doesn't have a hearing, doesn't give notification to victims or district attorney about that. And so if that is this committee's intent that the board do so, I would encourage that to be specific in the statute. Because right now what we are doing is, under the 228.1c, is doing it by file pass, making a determination. If we make a determination that there should be a hearing, that's when everyone gets the information and we have a full-blown hearing, everyone has the notification, and then a release decision is made or not. So I just put that forth for the committee's consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Two thoughts. First, my first might be way off base, and hopefully my second is less so. And I'll say jurisprudence fewer times, although I appreciated the multiple uses. Wouldn't it be simpler, and might it help cure constitutional questions, if we made clear the categories of offenders who would fit into the category that we'd be creating of parolees who didn't receive two-year hearings? And then the judge, at time of sentencing, would just say, you're in this category, okay, category 1 through 5, category 1 through 10, category whatever, and then that's that. And now it's not ex post facto because we make the determination then and just say this is the kind of thing that gets criminal who gets reviewed regularly and this is the kind of criminal who doesn't. That's my first question. Second question, and that's the one I may be way off base, but maybe not. And my second is maybe just a comment. No, it's a question. It does seem to me that it might be a better bill. I think we all share the interest in not having a situation where victims have to tell their very painful stories more oftentimes than is helpful. Wouldn't we at the same time be more heartened if there were a set of standards, if there were a set of rationale that we had some confidence with about when, you know, the kind of offenses that we're talking about or the kind of offenders we're talking about? And why don't we want to have that in the bill? If it's, I could understand an argument about whether we're just going to miss the hurdle or just going to clear the hurdle on constitutionality, but why wouldn't we want to have the standards so that we knew we were clearing the hurdle and feeling like we were making a better bill?
Looking at me, Chair Barker, Representative Smith, perhaps it might be easiest if we all sort of address questions as a panel.
You'd probably address the second one, and the first one you can address.
Sure. Right.
But in this order, in that other order, two, then one. Nice. Okay. Jurisprudence, go.
On number two, let me see if I'm...
Question again?
Question number two, we're talking about...
Why don't we want to have rationale and standards in there?
Okay. Well, then I want to make sure that I'm understanding the question. offenders, like, why can't we... Is it a better bill if there is the specificity of what types of offenders we're going to be applying this to,
yep.
Who would be eligible or not eligible, yep, for the various hearings? My response to that is that although what Mr. James says is true, that in Georgia and what's the other state?
California.
It was, I believe, murder-specific provisions. The universe in Oregon is not that much radically broader. We are still only talking about those persons that would appear before the parole board, and those are, as I described earlier, I hate to use cliches, but here I go, the worst of the worst offenders in many ways. It's murderers, it is people that are classified as dangerous offenders, and it is people that are committed the appropriate sort of crimes prior to November 1st, 1989. That's it. That's the universe. So it is a limited universe that we're already existing, that exists from the start. The only other comment that I'll make, and I apologize if this isn't as completely responsive, but I understand why Georgia and Texas enacted the provisions that they did, but those were murder specific, but the impacts on the victims, as you can imagine, are certainly as traumatic with many crimes other than murder. And so the intent of the bill and what we're trying to accomplish, we're really missing a huge piece if we just limit it to murder victims, where, in a sense, by definition, the actual victim is no longer there. The family, of course, would be impacted, but to limit it, we wouldn't be including persons like Miss Edens, or persons like with the Diane Downs case, that not all of the victims in that case were actually killed. That's not entirely responsive, but hopefully that's helpful.
A little bit.
And Representative Smith, with respect to your first question, so having...
The sentencing, why don't we have the judge put him in a category?
Yes. If having the sentencing judge make the designation, two answers. Theoretically, would that change the ex post facto analysis? Not very much. Practically, yeah, it would, because if we're talking about a sentencing judge, we're probably talking about something that's happening right about now. Now, I grant you their crime conviction may have been in the past, so there's a little bit of squishy wiggle room there, but we're probably talking about a prospective application anyway. And then there's also the practical realities of if the bill were required that way and you wanted to apply it to people currently who have already been sentenced but are now serving incarceration, would they have to go back and have the sentencing judge designate them at this point?
it'd be up to you as to how that would work, but a bit of a problem there, I think.
More people signed up. Mr. Chair, or
Mr. Barton, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A response to, I suppose, the question Representative Smith asked Mr. Stanford. I first of all, I do think this would be a better bill if it were more clear in the statute. As you know, I've expressed some reservations about delegating that discretion, with all due respect, to the parole board. That said, I do not believe it is necessary to be in the statute to survive constitutional scrutiny.
We might agree on that.
And I also recognize how important this bill is and the time constraint we're in. It's unfortunate that that is the case. If that could be clarified further in the Senate, that would please me. But that's also sort of the nature of my previous statement, that I intend to scrutinize the regulations as a result of this statute very, very closely. And if they are not done with sufficient clarity, I for one, intend to address them in the next legislative session. I hope others will join me.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, panel. Committee, what I would like to do today is, although another opinion seems a little bit redundant, but I'd like to move the dash fives today, and then we'll carry this over till Monday, when we hopefully will have the fiscal on it. And yes.
Okay. It takes me 2 weeks. 10 months. It's 2 weeks to get one.
Maybe I'll have Shannon do it. She gets them a lot quicker.
Or they don't. Maybe they're still mad at me down there. I don't know.
I thought that was
his name.
That was funny.
Well,
okay. That would be awfully quick. Well, I would like to have, there has been notified by some of the members, they would like to hear an opinion from Mr. Nasby on this. I think we can have that back by Monday. And so what I would like to do then today is adopt the dash fives, and then we'll take another look at this on Monday.
Mr. Chair.
A question, Mr. Chair, a question perhaps of counsel. Well, Mr. Nasby's opinion, are we asking for a formal advisory opinion that actually will bind us?
It won't bind us. We're asking for an opinion to make some people more comfortable.
I see.
Chairman of the committee, I just got off the phone with Mr. Nasby. I talked to him about the difference in burden of proof. He still thinks it's constitutional. Can he have an opinion by Monday? Yes. It means there are other things that will be hung up.
Yeah.
One thing I would suggest is that we get the opinion as the bill moves to the other chamber, if that's okay, Mr. Chair. I've got, so many amendments down there, and we've got 40 bills on next week, and he's our primary drafter for criminal law issues. And I don't mean him.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair. I will be a no vote on the amendment today, just because I don't have, I need to see the opinion before I can be comfortable supporting this, but I gather you may have the support on the committee to move this amendment. I also would like to see, this is a fairly significant piece of policy, and I think the dash 5 amendment is a great improvement, but is not quite right. We've heard testimony about how this could be improved further, and I fully appreciate the workload issues, but I would like to see some additional refinement to the amendment before I can support it. So that's my position.
Okay. And this will have a fiscal, and we'll probably be going to Ways and Means. It's going to be referred to Ways and Means.
Is that?
Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, we're just adopting the amendment today.
Today.
I would just like to argue, I suppose, to the committee, that even opponents, those neutral, I think everyone that I've heard of would argue that the bill with the dash 5 amendments is a better bill than the unamended version, such that to the extent any of us might feel reservations about the constitutionality under ex post facto clause over the bill itself, I still would love to encourage support for the dash 5s.
My
Mr. Chair, I think a lot of people have talked about how this, the intent is not to add a punishment here, but I think from the policy perspective, this could have that effect, and that what you would often be doing is providing additional pressure on the parole board to move this out based on the pressures of the environment, the media perhaps weighing in. So I think this could have significant constitutional challenges based on that. And that coupled with Representative Garrett's concerns, and he's the lawyer of the bunch, I'll also be voting no on the amendment.
Was he sliced liver?
He's a lawyer. Okay.
Reggie. For the record, Judy Stigler is also a lawyer.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith, are you an attorney?
Yeah, I have been before. The question, if it has, if this goes to Ways and Means, this is obviously a rookie question, will it also get scrutiny in the Judiciary Committee on the Senate side?
No.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that depends. If it goes to Ways and Means Committee, it does not necessarily have to go to a substantive committee. In the sense that, at least my experience, it goes back, the process, I think it goes back to Ways and Means and then comes back to the floor. It could also go to Senate Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, therefore, Mr. Chair, I won't be in favor of moving this bill thinking that the Senate Judiciary Committee is going to fix it, because we have no confidence the Senate Judiciary Committee is even going to hear it, and because we know that the Ways and Means process is not supposed to make policy changes. Now, I know that under extraordinary circumstances we can do that, but I don't know why we would choose that extraordinary measure rather than the slightly less extraordinary measure of dealing with the workload issues at the front end.
Chair, members of the committee, bills usually of this nature do go to Judiciary Committee, but they don't have to. They usually do because of the legal issues involved.
Before they go to Ways and Means.
Go to Ways and Means, yeah.
They go to the substitute.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move the dash fives in the House Bill 2335.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash fives in the House Bill 2335. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. The dash fives are adopted. And I'll close the work session on House Bill.
Mr. Chair, can I say something on the record?
Yep.
On the record, let me just say, I still feel the same way about moving this to the Senate. I agree with Representative Barton that these amendments don't make it constitutionally more infirm. They do probably make it policy better and constitutionally less infirm. So I'm comfortable with the amendments, but that doesn't mean I'm comfortable with the amendments going into law or going to the floor or going to the Senate side until we work to make a fix. So unless we until we address those questions, I'll be voting with Representative Garrett against the moving the bill forward.
Okay, we're not moving the bill today.
I know that.
Close the work session, House Bill 2335. And we will be moving House Bill 3348 to Monday. Be carrying it. Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2713.
House Bill 2713 was first heard on March 18th. House Bill 2713 provided that all public safety officers are covered by the provisions of ORS 236-350, where previously only police officers were covered. Creates detailed process and safeguards for the public safety officer who's under investigation, provides that certain investigations and officer misconduct must be completed within 6 months of the allegation, modifies current procedure for an officer to request and receive a copy of personnel records, creates procedures for placing, reviewing, and challenging an adverse comment in a public safety officer's personnel file. You have dash one and dash two amendments in front of you. Both of them, I believe, deal with the duration of an investigation into an allegation of misconduct. Specifically, the dash twos extend the investigation for up to 12 months with written notice and an explanation of the reason why it would be 12 months, whereas in the original bill it was 6 months. And I believe Mr. DeLashmet and perhaps Mr. Barenberger here to discuss the merits of the two amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be extremely brief. The dash ones are my amendments in response to Representative Barton's concerns about sections 4, A, B, and C, and also in response to the issue about the timing or the extent of the time for the investigation. We originally had 6 months. We were willing to go another 90 days. The only difference between the dash ones and the dash twos, in both cases, they delete 4, A, B, and C. The dash twos, however, go to a year, so it'd be 6 months plus 6 months. Quite frankly, after the discussion you just had, I'm going to make it very simple on you. I don't care. If you want to do the dash twos, I can live with that. The bill still gets the main body of what we want, and we do want to have some end, some termination to the total time of the investigation. So whether it's a total of 9 months or 12 months, at this point, I could care less.
Thank you. Okay. I've talked to the chief of police in Portland, and this could be true with a smaller department as well. Sometimes they have a very complicated case. It's not the desire overall of management to try to tie these things up forever and ever. It's tough on the officer who's under investigation. It's also hard on the department to not get these things resolved for their own morale of the other people. So I would be inclined to ask for a motion to accept the dash twos.
Mr. Chair, I move dash twos in the House Bill 2713.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash twos in the House Bill 2713. Is there any discussion? Representative Cameron?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure it's in regards to the amendment, but I'll ask the question now. And maybe Mr. DeLashmith can clarify this. Does this bill, whether it's amended with the dash twos or the threes, would this bill honor existing collective bargaining agreements?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I've been asked that question a couple of times, including by the representative from the chiefs of police. It's our intent that this would make, for the future, the floor for what agencies are supposed to use. I would assume that while there's still a collective bargaining agreement in effect, that would, in fact, be the agreement that's in effect as how they're going to be handling these. As they go through a revision of the collective bargaining agreement, I believe that they would be using this as kind of their template or their Bible to go forward.
Follow up for me. So what I just heard was that if the existing collective bargaining agreement does not meet this standard, that this standard overrides it today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, perhaps I wasn't as clear as I should have been, but I would believe that it would be when that collective bargaining agreement is up in the future and this doesn't, and their bargaining agreement doesn't meet this standard, then in fact they would have to alter their collective bargaining agreement. Or, quite frankly, if this were in place and both parties are comfortable with this as the standard, they wouldn't even have to have this in their collective bargaining agreement, because in fact it would be in statute on how you handle these situations.
So, Cam will come up.
Go ahead.
Just to clarify then, so
the twos are his.
If there is an existing agreement in a collective bargaining agreement today, that would supersede this, what's in this bill. Until that collective bargaining agreement comes up again?
Again, Barker, Representative Cameron, yes, I believe that is the case.
The contract would supersede this.
And again, Chairman Barker and Representative Cameron, it's my understanding that most of the collective bargaining agreements not only have these provisions, but they have additional provisions in them already that would be much more stringent or much more complex than this. This is simply a template of what we believe would be the minimum standard.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to find in here where an existing collective bargaining agreement would supersede this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, through collective bargaining and through PECLA statutes, an employer and an employee group can, in fact, come to an agreement that doesn't have to be something that's in statute. So I guess what I'm trying to portray to you is that if their standards are more stringent than this, in fact, the collective bargaining agreement on those points would supersede what is laid out in this particular statute because both parties agreed to it.
So I just want to be clear. So what I just heard was only if it is stronger than this does an existing collective bargaining agreement.
This is the standard.
I just want to be clear. This is what we're saying is we're going to pass a bill that would wipe out an existing collective bargaining agreement that doesn't meet this standard today. That's what I just heard.
And again, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, this effective date is not until, I believe, I believe it has a emergency clause on it, so there is going to be some time, obviously, if something doesn't meet that standard, but it would be my understanding or expectation, and obviously we could review this on the Senate side, that if it didn't meet the standard and the bargaining agreement didn't come open between now and then, that we, in fact, probably could clean up that. But it would be my understanding that this would be going to affect, but if there was a bargaining agreement that was in effect that both parties, the employer and the employee group, had signed off on, that this would not supersede it until that agreement was opened. But we can clarify that on the Senate side if there's still confusion.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I know what Brian's trying to say here, but what he just said confused me just now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I mean, seriously, I know where you want to go with this, but how you just explained that there, Representative Cameron, I mean, I know where you want to go.
With Mr. Chair, I apologize if I confused you.
Got it? Okay. Okay, thank you. Kevin, you satisfied?
I'm not sure I'm satisfied, but I'm not sure you want to hear from me either, okay. So it's up to you. Okay.
Well, if you would like to say something, you're more than welcome.
It'll be quick, I promise.
Okay.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, thanks for just a minute on this. I realize this isn't the subject of the amendment, and you know, Brian and I will continue to discuss this regardless of where the bill goes. But our concern was a simple one, and it is that if you have an existing agreement, it may or may not look like the language of this bill. The bill obviously came from language out of California. I think there is language in this that is adopted in many of the collective bargaining agreements, but I'm guessing there are segments of this that are different. And so my concern is, in the event that you have a difference between this statute and the bargained agreement, which one takes precedent? And if it's not, how do you determine whether it's stronger, better, or whether it's just different? And so in my mind, the desire would be, one, you know, we had some issues we'd love to discuss, little things. We can do that on the Senate side, but it would be helpful to us if we knew that this either superseded bargained agreements and took the place of them, or did not supersede it and covered in any environment where a collective bargaining agreement doesn't exist, where officers don't have these protections. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate you even letting me come up. I appreciate that. And I know it's been a long week and a long hearing in addition to that. So,
without my good friend Will Aitchison sitting at a table, it's my understanding from years gone by that the collective bargaining agreement is what supersedes, unless it would be a violation of law. That's the rule.
I think that's exactly
for the collective. Yeah.
I think that's right.
And Mr. Chair, that was what I was trying to communicate, but I didn't do a very good job of.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I wouldn't know this, but in the event that would be challengeable based on what? Are we creating new challenges to this?
I don't believe we are. This is really pretty old language coming out from days gone by and Senate Bill 750. Well, actually, they didn't take this out in Senate Bill 750. It was never in. And it was just, having been involved in earlier efforts at this many years ago, we were just trying to set a floor, especially for smaller police departments that may not have had collective bargaining units, where people weren't getting what we thought was a fair hearing in disciplinary action. So we wanted to just set a floor for the professional police officers, real police officers, to be protected from arbitrary injustice, I guess I should say, in hearings cases. And this was just a floor that we were trying to put in years ago. But as since that time, most police departments do have collective bargaining. And most chiefs abide by this. Okay, so we have the twos out there. Okay, thank you. We have the motion to move the dash two amendments into House Bill 2713. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
It's ready to go.
Okay.
You want to move? You want who's going to talk? Carry on the
talk. Have you got a fiscal?
There is no fiscal.
No fiscal. No, we've got it. Okay, go ahead.
We're good.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2713 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2713 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion, Representative Barton?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to briefly thank Mr. DeLashmit for his cooperation. He came back to me several times and as we reviewed it, and I really appreciate his approach.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cameron.
I think I'm going to be a no in committee until it's very clear to me.
Okay, fair enough.
I still can't find that this is that this says if there's an existing collective bargaining agreement that's what would prevail, and so I'm going to be a no until that's clear, and maybe we need to make sure that language is in here, that it's clear. Someplace along the road. So I'll be a no here in committee to bring that issue up.
Okay, call roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Trigger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bennett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry the bill. Open a work session on House Bill 2313.
House Bill 2313, first heard on January 27th and again on March 31st, clarifies several statutes relating to trust in estates, changes the language of a trust to a trustee of a trust, and an estate to personal representative of an estate. We've had multiple versions of this bill. We had the dash fours before the committee at this time. It's my understanding that the issues that have been brought up were some of the cross references that have been in the various incarnations of the bill, and that the language then changing the definition of a trust and an estate has had unintentional consequences with other agencies. My understanding as well is that the bar is worked with LC to take out some of those cross references, and that this is the finalized version. And I believe Mr. Niebel's here if you'd like to hear more about the dash fours.
Okay, does anybody need to hear more about the dash
just
fours?
A question.
Representative. Go ahead. Yeah, we're running out of time here on a Friday afternoon.
I just have a question. My notes reflected that we had previously adopted the dash three.
We did.
Okay. So this would supersede, that, not to use an overused term in the last 10 minutes, but this would supersede the dash three.
It would, yeah.
Okay.
Representative Barton recommend a yes on this? Because I'm sure he's read it.
Yeah, I've read the jurisprudence.
Okay, I'll accept the motion for the dash fours.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash fours in the House Bill 2313.
Representative Wisnett moves the dash fours in the House Bill 2313. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And we'll carry it until Monday. Open a work session on House Bill 2738.
House Bill 2738, first heard on March 16th, provides that a disabled or abandoned vehicle taken into custody by a public body will be sold or disposed of by the person engaged to tow the vehicle. You have dash twos in front of you, and I believe Al Elkins is here to discuss the dash twos.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Powell representing Oregon Sheriffs. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2738 was introduced by our association to again streamline a process that leads to the sale of towed abandoned vehicles. Currently, under the law, the sheriff and a towing agency are tasked with doing basically the same thing at the same time under different statutes. And what happens with the sheriff's process is the sheriff's process ends in a resolution whereby the purchaser of one of these vehicles that's been abandoned and in danger on our highways, it leaves them with a branded title, which diminishes the value of the automobile. Under the lien law, or under the law that the tow companies can end up getting a title to, they end up getting a clean title. So what happens is the sheriff's office has to go through the appraisal of these vehicles, notification and to the owner, and all of those processes. And at the end of the day, what they end up with is thrown away, and the tow operator uses the process they do because they need to recover as much value from this to cover their costs of the tow. So the result is the Dash 2 amendments that basically remove the sheriff from this process, and they the law enforcement agency requests the tow. If they can give the tow operator the complete information of the owner's address and that sort of thing, within 48 hours they notify the owner and can go through the process then of, if they don't get a response from that owner, of disposing of the automobile. Short of that, if they don't get complete information from the law enforcement agency, they use Chapter 87 law to do the same thing. It just takes longer. But at the end of the day, that's what's going to happen anyway, and this just simply removes the sheriff from all of that process, including getting an appraisal and those sorts of things. So the Dash 2 amendments are really a credit to Mr. Elkins' work more than mine, meeting with the civil deputies and making sure that we got it right.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, he said it all. Okay, thank you. Okay, I'd accept a motion for the Dash 2s, to adopt the Dash 2s on 2738.
Mr. Chair,
President Stigler,
the Dash 2 be to House Bill 2738 be adopted.
No. Representative Stigler moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2738. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered, and that will adopt that and carry that over till Monday.
We don't have a fiscal on that yet.
Reopen House Bill, work session House Bill 2313.
2313, the Dash 4s were just amended, and it turns out that we do have, or the Dash 4s were just adopted, and we do have the no expenditure non-statement, so we can move the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move House Bill 2313 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2313 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think Representative Garrett is uniquely qualified to carry this bill.
I was going to move this one to the consent calendar, but there's no objection.
Nominal.
Yeah. Thank you.
So what is
consent.
Okay. That's your brother.
Open a public hearing. Got a couple more here. We'll zip through them. House Bill 3271.
Go, brother.
Let's see. House Bill 3271, first heard on April 3rd, increased the penalty for harassment under certain circumstances when a person subjects a victim to harm, to alarm by conveying a threat to inflict serious physical injury against the victim or victim's family, or to commit a felony against the person or property of the victim or victim's family. We now have Dash 2s before each of the members, and I believe these are from Representative Stigler.
Yes. Thank you, Council. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What I did was work to try to bring the dash twos into conformance with some concerns that have been addressed specifically. They set out very, very concisely the conditions under which there would be an elevation to a Class C felony. It would require, first of all, that that subsection 1C had been previously committed, and then it lists a variety of different circumstances in combination with that wherein it would elevate it to a Class C felony, the first instance being that there's been a previous conviction for harassment in under these circumstances, and the victim of the current offense was the victim or member of the family of the victim of the previous offense, or at the time that there was a stalking protective order, restraining order, or any other court order prohibiting contact between the person and the victim. At the time the offense was committed, that the person reasonably believed the victim to be under 18 and more than 3 years younger than the person. These are those kind of situations that you have where you go on the MySpace page, and that kind of scenario where you're thinking you're luring a younger victim into your situation. And I would like to thank Ms. Myers for the language in regard to that. And then the final one is the situation where there is a threat to kill, but it is very carefully couched in language, hopefully that will meet constitutional scrutiny. Specifically, the language highlighted in little 2i and little 3i. I never have known how to refer to those. But so essentially it has to be a colorable threat. There has to be a real expectation that the threat is other than just saying, I'm going to kill you, that kind of thing. So hopefully this brings it down to a discrete number of situations that this kind of crime would refer to. And finally, it brought it into conformance as well with a definition of electronic threat that was in some other legislation that we've recently passed to include the cellular system language that we had included in that.
Okay. Accept a motion to adopt the dash twos.
I'd move the dash twos, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Stigler moves the dash twos into House Bill 3271. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. I'm going to close the hearing. There's, at present time, a subsequent referral of Ways and Means. I think the dash will correct that, and so we'll have a look at that. Carry it till Monday. Open, we have just very short time here to take to do the next two. House, open a work session, House Bill 2262.
House Bill 2262, we heard yesterday, and the amendments were the dash twos were adopted. We have a minimal expenditure impact statement, and it's ready to be moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2262 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2262 to the floor with the do pass. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative
Bolton? Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Who would like to carry that? Anybody in particular? Okay, Representative Barton, you got it. Thank you. Opening work session on House Bill 2264.
It's justice.
2264 was likewise heard yesterday. We adopted the dash ones. The letter of referral has been rescinded by the Speaker's office. It had a minimal fiscal impact statement and can be moved today.
Okay.
Ready to go ahead?
Yeah.
No amendments or dash. You got
the dash ones.
They're already adopted.
Dash ones, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2264 is amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2264 to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Speaker?
Excused.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman? Chair Barker?
Aye, yeah. Motion carries. Representative Garrett will be a carrier. I'm going to briefly reopen House Bill 2139 for the purpose of allowing Representative Wisnett to vote. Representative Wisnett, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett votes aye. Close the public hearing. Adjourn the meeting.